You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Ancient tools and burials, plants and seeds, Neanderthals. All these things we make no apology for the study of archaeology. But we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast, episode 31. I'm your host, Sarah, with my co-host, Ken Fader. And today, we're talking about the Solutrean Hypothesis and the Bering Strait. What is the Solutrean Hypothesis? What does it mean? And how did people actually get to the Americas? Get ready to think critically.
No, we don't do dinosaurs. Digging in a trench, monuments, going to the...
Hey, everyone, and welcome back. Hey, Ken, how's it going?
It's going all right, Sarah. We're all waiting here in the Northeast for the big chill, the big freeze coming. It's going to kill us all, so I'm glad we're doing this before that happens, because this could be our last podcast, because we're all going to freeze.
You know,
glaciers
speaking...
are coming back. Mammoths are coming back.
I was going to say,
a mess.
Speaking of glaciers and freezing, we...
Yeah, exactly.
Great transition. We are going to talk about migration myths today, particularly Bering Strait myths and the Solutrean.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about how did people get here in the first place.
Yes.
Here being the New World, North
yeah,
America.
Yeah, yeah. We're specifically focusing on North America. Well, the Americas, I suppose.
Right.
And we are not delving into like Native American myths or that kind of thing. I know there's some bad blood between the Bering Strait migration theory and Native American oral histories in general.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. I have a brief story to tell. A bunch of years ago, I was invited to be on a radio program in Hartford, and they invited a couple of archaeologists, there was a museum person, and a number of Native Americans to talk about the relationship between archaeology and Native Americans, because most archaeologists here in the Northeast, and it's probably true in most of North America, are not native people, and yet the stuff that we're studying was left by the ancestors of the native people.
Right.
Anyway, so the Bering Land Bridge, we'll talk more about that in a little bit, but the whole notion of how did Native Americans get to America, when did that happen, what was the source population, we got into that. And it was a very friendly conversation, and we agreed to disagree. But essentially what I was told by a couple of the Native Americans was that we archaeologists were claiming that Native Americans were latecomers to this continent and therefore no different from the European settlers of the 16th and 17th centuries. And my reaction to that was, hey, listen, we don't believe that there were human beings in the New World. The people didn't evolve here, that in fact Native Americans came from someplace. But my God, we're saying it's 10 or 20 or 30,000 years ago. So we're not saying that you guys are latecomers or newcomers. And that argument just did not sit well with them. Their assertion was that it was insulting somehow to Native Americans and their culture to say that they came from somewhere else. And they, in fact, now, and every Native American tribe is going to have a different origin story, like everybody else in the world. But these folks maintain that, in fact, all Native American creation stories or origin stories posited that they were formed here, that they have always been here. And yeah, that puts them at odds with what the scientific evidence indicates. And it was unfortunate that we got into this, you know, this kind of argument between religion and science, and that whenever that happens, it's a toxic mixture. And we all went away with our own opinion, but I think there is that dynamic between the stories told by Native people and how the archaeological record is interpreted by scientists.
I think I can kind of see their point with the whole, like, comparing them, being compared to white settlers when they finally got here. I understand why they might not want to have that comparison
right.
made.
And you know,
but I don't think anybody at any point was like, I don't feel like anyone from the archaeology end has ever tried to say, you know, you're wrong, you know, right. Stop being stupid, that kind of thing. I mean, regardless of when they got here, they're still the first people in America. Right. So, I mean,
yeah, of course. But and I think that we archaeologists have to own up a little bit to the history of the white scientists who were trying to explain who Native Americans were and where they came from.
Right.
And there is a history there. There is a history there of people, for example, we've talked about mound builders, denying and Native Americans were in any way associated with the builders of the mounds. And in fact, there were claims made in the 18th and 19th centuries that Native Americans were, in fact, a very recent represented a recent population movement into the New World, where there already were all these Europeans building mounds. And so I think that when with that as context, you certainly can understand why people would be a little bit suspicious of, again, mostly white scientists saying, well, no, we know where you people came from.
Right.
And
no.
I get that. But ultimately, whatever you think of us or whatever the argument, whatever the source of the argument is, we have data, and the data can be interpreted objectively, and that has nothing whatsoever to do with somebody's story of origin, their origin story.
Right. I mean,
it doesn't have to have anything to do with it anyway.
We kind of touched on this topic in the last podcast where we're talking about origin myths and oral histories. So, you know, I mean, it's a delicate balance to strike, but I mean, like I said, there's room for us to be respectful of other cultures, and there is also room for us to say, hey, these are the facts. You know,
I
don't think in a situation like this, I don't feel like one trumps the other unless you're doing certain things with it. Like if you're trying to study the origin of or the movement of human people across the planet, then you're going to have to default on the side of science here. If you're trying to understand Native American cultures and Native American peoples, then you're going to have to default with the side of their oral histories and their mythology. So
yeah, and you know, and ultimately, you know, between geology, archaeology, anthropology, history, and genetics, we have a pretty good idea of how and when the continent, the New World, was populated.
Yes, and like I said, Native American issues aside, there is some really weird fringe stuff surrounding the Bering Strait, and I was not quite prepared for it when I looked it up. Apparently, did you know that it is possible to some groups that the Bering Strait ice shelf did not exist ever?
I mean, the land bridge.
Oh, no. The ice shelf.
I'm not even sure what they're talking about.
I know.
You know,
I think they think when we are talking about the Bering land bridge, I think people actually imagine it as a connection of the glacier. And they think people crossed on the glacier itself.
Yeah. I think part of the problem here is that the kind of common parlance, the vernacular, is we talk about the Bering land bridge. And I think people then get this idea in their mind of this kind of narrow connection between the old and new worlds. And that, you know, you kind of had to tiptoe across like a tightrope walker. And it was so narrow that only skinny people could get across.
Right.
What we're talking about is an exposure of land that is about 1,000 miles from north to south, something like that. This is not some narrow little bridge, which is why many people in sciences no longer call it the Bering Land Bridge. They refer to it as Beringia. It is a huge expanse of land, and it didn't open up overnight. It's something that slowly happened. I mean, I have the story that I tell my students is that imagine if you're living in Northeast Asia and you see the tide come in, you see the tide go out, and you know, I mean, the Sarah Palin was almost right when she said that when she said she could see Russia from her house.
This is true. Yes.
She could actually probably could see some of the islands that are in Russian territorial waters. So it's only about 90 miles across. And as the sea level slowly dropped as a result of so much of the Earth's water being tied up in glaciers and not melting in the spring and
right.
covering parts of North America and parts of high elevations in the Northern Hemisphere especially, that as that water, it's like letting water out of a bathtub, it's slowly exposed. And I'm sure there were people in Northeast Asia who began really could see that there's a land out there. And as the tide went out, you could walk to it. And as long as you got back in time, you were fine. And that eventually that tidal area became fully exposed and animals started walking, that plants started growing on it. And I get in my fantasy, it's like the old people are telling the young people, you know, back in my day, you couldn't walk out over there. And they're right. saying, oh yeah, sure, grandpa, whatever you say. And they're not probably aware of the fact that there is two entire continents on the other end of that pipeline, but there's more territory there. There's plants and there are animals. Let's follow. And slowly, not even intentionally, they had become truly the first Americans. But anybody who says that there's no Bering land bridge or what it's not even worth responding to. The geology, the glacial geology, the presence of animals on either side of the land bridge. It's undeniable. The marine biologists, marine geologists, some people doing geology under the water, and the archaeology of both the Western Beringia, which would be Northeast Asia today, and Eastern Beringia, which would be Alaska today. There's no debate there whatsoever. When a lot of water is locked up on land as ice and doesn't melt, which is what happened during large stretches of the Pleistocene,
right?
The world's coasts become reconfigured, and you know, we're going to talk a little bit about the Solutrean hypothesis. That also relies on the same thing: the fact that there's a land bridge, say from Western Europe to North America, but that the presence of ice in the North Atlantic, making the trip not as long. In other words, you can hop from ice flow to ice flow that maritime people could conceivably have entered into the New World from Western Europe more readily than one could today, for example.
The Solutrean hypothesis is an interesting one only because the Solutrean culture is so old. Because the Solutrean culture, is it a culture? It's not even a culture, it's a phase, isn't it?
Oh, you know, those terms, I think most people refer to Solutrean as culture. Solutrean was probably at its peak around 17,000 years ago.
But it's mainly a European, it's a European thing.
Yeah.
But it's so old that it's one of those groups where we don't really have a lot of stuff for them.
There's a lot. I mean, the Solutrean lithics are amazing and spectacular.
Yeah.
And we can just step back a little bit. One of the primary proponents of the Solutrean hypothesis, along with Dennis Stanford, is Bruce Bradley. And Bruce Bradley is Bruce and Dennis, Stanford and Bradley, are extremely smart guys with an amazing track record in archaeology, and Bruce especially in terms of lithic replication. I don't know anybody on the planet who knows more about stone tools and replicating stone tools than Bruce Bradley. I use his video, which is his flint knapping video, I use in my experimental archaeology class. And I tell everybody, this guy, this is Yoda right here. You know, when you want to channel the force for making stone tools, listen to and watch Bruce Bradley. And Bradley comes at this from the perspective of somebody who is extremely knowledgeable about lithic technology. And so when Bruce Bradley says there are some extremely deep similarities between Solutrean lithic technology and the lithic technology in North America, late Pleistocene, early Holocene lithic technology in North America, it's certainly, that is a reasonable hypothesis that there is a connection there. And he's a really smart guy and he knows what he's talking about. But, and we have to always put in that, but the mere fact that there are these very interesting similarities, that calls for testing. That calls for additional data or evidence to support that the hypothesis that maybe, in fact, those first Americans were not Asians walking across the Bering Land Bridge or traveling along the Bering Land Bridge coast, but were a maritime people living in Western Europe with a Solutrean technology. And that leads to a lot of problems because, number one, yeah, the Solutrean stuff is a lot older than Clovis. I mean, it's thousands. There's about a 5,000-year difference between Clovis and Solutrean. So what happens in those 5,000 years? There's absolutely no evidence that the Solutrean were a maritime people. So there's, while, you know, the absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence, but nevertheless, we cannot find any support in the archaeological record for the Solutrean people being maritime, being folks with boats who one might imagine could sail from Western Europe to the New World, even if it's, you know, from ice flow to ice flow.
And without that, that's why I'm saying that the Solutrean hypothesis gets thorny. Not that I support the idea that there were Solutreans in America. I'm just saying the culture and the time period was so far in the past that the evidence for the people themselves is very thin. I mean, we know they existed and we've got a lot of their stone tool technology from what I understand, but like culturally, we don't know a lot about them, right?
Well, I mean, we know that they were just as the Clovis people, they were reliant on megafauna because they're living in Europe during a time of a glacial maximum. And so not a lot of plant foods, at least much of the year. So yeah, these guys are hunters and gatherers, and they probably had a major, I mean, look at their stone tools. Clearly a lot of that stuff is geared towards big game hunting.
Yeah.
Certainly hunting. And so we know that. The problem is, I mean, when you, I wonder sometimes if maybe people who look at the very deep elements of the lithic technology of Solutreans and of, say, Clovis or even pre-Clovis, if they're, you know, they're not looking, they can't see the forest for the trees. They're looking at all these details, but when you come down to it, there are no Solutrean fluted points, for example. So you've got the fluted point, which is the most characteristic or certainly the most diagnostic of the technologies that define Clovis and then Folsom. And we don't see that at all in Solutrean. Are they making beautiful bifaces with all this gorgeous retouch flanking? Yeah, sure they are. But the actual Solutrean points, as beautiful as they are, and as symmetrical as they are, and as beautiful and symmetrical as Clovis points are, they don't look alike. They are not the same.
No, they don't. Yeah, they don't look anything alike, really. I've seen some Clovis points, and I've seen pictures of the Solutrean points, and they're not anywhere near identical.
Right. And I think, you know, I do not claim to be a lithics expert.
No.
I think that somebody who has done, and I've got a student of mine who's done amazing work with Bruce Bradley, in fact, who's has replicated Solutrean stuff and replicated Clovis points and Folsom points. Somebody like that is going to be able to tell you on a much more visceral level what the similarities and differences are. But be that as it may, even if they are really super close, again, that kind of evidence merely suggests a hypothesis. And that's perfectly cool. That's what we do in science all the time.
Right.
We look at one datum, we look at little piece of evidence, we go, wait, maybe we can explain that by, maybe we can explain the similarities between Clovis and Solutrean by a historical and biological connection, that those people came to the New World. That's a perfectly valid hypothesis. The problem then is, okay, well, let's test that hypothesis. And we look at the data, the genetic data, for example. We look at the archaeological data as well. We look at the chronological data. It just doesn't fit. It doesn't support the claim that, well, yeah, these guys here in the Northeast, at least in the Northeast, came from Western Europe.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we'll keep looking at the Solutrians and see where we're going with this, because we're going someplace cool.
The CRM Archaeology Podcast brings together a panel of cultural resource management professionals to discuss the issues that really matter to the profession. Find out about networking strategies, job hunting, graduate programs, and much more. We'll often feature interviews with college professors, CRM business owners, and experts as well. Check out the show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Let's get back to the show.
And we are back, and we are talking about the Solutrean culture. And Ken, the reason we're talking about this is because I know that there was a Solutrean looking point that was found.
Sinmar, right?
Sinmar, in the Sinmar shipwreck. No, it was found by the Sinmar ship.
Yeah, they were dredging, right?
They were dredging, and they pulled up a Solutrean point. I don't think there's any debate that it is a Solutrean point. And it was found in association with some megafauna bones. I don't remember what types of bones. The problem is that it was very close to the American border, the North American border, which would suggest that it is possible that the Solutrean culture made it to North America.
We got to backtrack here a little bit.
We can, yeah.
No. Let's backtrack a little tiny bit. First of all, you know, one of the things that we've been yelling out about a lot on this podcast is the whole notion of context, yes, association, and provenience.
Yes.
So that, for example, we talked about the Roman sword. When somebody tells us that this was a genuine Roman sword and it was found in a shipwreck, the thing that we've been doing, that we've asked, is, all right, well, where are the field notes for that archaeological excavation?
Right.
Where are the maps? Where are the photographs? Where are the measurements of this thing in situ, in provenience? And that doesn't exist. The same is true of the Sinmar biface. We hear, oh, yeah, this was dredged up by a particular ship in a particular area on a particular day. There is no evidence that I've seen that confirms any of that. So in other words, it's a just so story. It's, well, just trust us, it came up while dredging, and here's where it was located, and here's the depth of our dredge. And unfortunately, none of that has been verified, at least to the satisfaction of skeptics.
Right.
Now, dredges in the Atlantic off the coast of North America have done amazing stuff, and there are maps of mastodon, I don't know if it's mastodon or mammoth, teeth or tusk fragments that have been brought up by dredges. And there have been enough of those so that you actually have people drawing where the, because these are animals probably weren't swimming. And it's far.
Oh, didn't you know mammoths were very strong swimmers?
Well, you know,
that's what that trunk was for. It's like a propeller.
You know, listen, they have dwarf mammoths on Santa Rosa Island off the coast of California, who, if I'm not mistaken, they believe they actually did get there by swimming, and they end up being dwarfed. There's island dwarfing. It's a real interesting
two things.
Story of biogeography.
You take all the fun out of my snipe, out of my snark when you prove me right. And two, I want a dwarf mammoth now.
Oh, wouldn't you love one of those?
Seriously? Wouldn't that be adorable?
Can we have just a sidebar on this? What's weird is I'm 63, so I'm supposed to be old and kind of conservative and stodgy. And my students are supposed to be all progressive and excited about stuff. And when I bring up the possibility of cloning, you know, bringing back extinct species like mammoths or maybe dinosaurs, my students, these kids in their teens and 20s, say, oh, that would be terrible. That would be horrible. It's the mark of the devil. And I'm thinking, how cool would that be?
It's because they were all raised on Jurassic Park. That ruined it for everyone.
I want a woolly mammoth, for God's sake.
I know. And, anyway.
You know, they're actually based on, I'm trying to remember now, I just saw an article somewhere, the quagga, which is a large kind of zebra-like animal in southern Africa, that is extinct. They have like quagga hides, and they've been able to do some genetic analysis of those, but they're extinct. But by finding the right kinds of zebras and doing all of these genetic crosses, they're actually, they're bringing back an animal who might not be genetically a quagga, but is certainly beginning to look like a quagga as opposed to a zebra or a horse. The quaggas only had stripes in the rear, the hindquarters.
Oh, yeah. I've seen pictures of those. Yeah.
And so...
drawings.
Damn it, bring back the Tasmanian tiger and the passenger pigeon and Tyrannosaurus Rex. I want a Tyrannosaurus Rex in my backyard.
No, you don't. Only if you can have a little mini one, and then it's like having an alligator.
All right. But then back to the point we're making. Right. So dredges have done some... Now, these are guys not dredging for artifacts or bones. They're dredging for other reasons, to make channels or whatever.
Right.
And they brought up some stuff, and there's been enough of this so that there are actual maps showing where the shoreline of North America might have been during the glacial maximum, because there's so many bits and pieces, and so many means dozens of bits and pieces of the bones of extinct animals that would have been attracted to that shoreline. So that's really pretty cool. So yeah, if there were Salutrian people living along the coast, the then coast, the 12,000, 14,000, 16,000, 17,000 year old coast of North America, perhaps they would have dropped a spear point and it's been brought up by a dredge. But man, you need a lot better provenience to support the notion that that particular art, and what it's a bi point. So in other words, there's a point on top and a point on the bottom. It's really cool. Now, Sarah, you say, oh, it's definitely Salutrian. I don't know about that. if you look at here in the Northeast, the kind of the Bible for the last 50 years of spear points and arrow points, so stone tools in this part of the world, has been William Ritchie, who was like the godfather of archaeology in New York State. William Ritchie's book, The Typology and Nomenclature of New York State Projectile Points. We use it in Connecticut. We use it in Massachusetts and Rhode Island when we are typing points. And you know what? There are a couple of point types from the Northeast that at least gross morphology looks a lot like the Sinmar artifact. That is, they are kind of oval shaped and they have a point on top and a point on the bottom. And so I am not.
But
really
aren't the okay? So here's my thing with that. I'm going to interrupt you, and I'm only doing this to play devil's advocate. My understanding of the Salutrian points is that they are very large, much like the Clovis points are very large in comparison to other points that came after them. So you're seeing similar spear points in your typology book. Is it possible that they're just looking similar, and when you have one in comparison to a Salutrian point, that they're size-wise they don't compare?
Yeah, but you know what? There's so much variation in size. I've got a cache of spear points that we excavated in the early 1990s, where these things are 8 and 9 inches long. Hmm. And they're ginormous.
Yeah.
Anybody who tells you that size doesn't matter, well, maybe in that other thing it doesn't. But when it comes to making spear points, I tell you, it's kind of impressive. So there's a lot of variation in size.
That's my point that we're keeping it classy on this podcast.
There you go. But see, that again, it's kind of a special pleading, but doesn't it look, one spear point, not very well provenienced, without a real chain of evidence leading us back to a particular spot at a particular depth, is, I understand folks who want to believe that that thing is Salutrian and that that thing is diagnostic and definitive, might complain about, we know what they're complaining about essentially is the old Carl Sagan maxim, which is that extreme claims require extreme levels of evidence or levels of proof.
Right.
And you know what? The Salutrian hypothesis, which by the way is not wasn't invented by Bruce Bradley and Dennis Stanford. There's an article in the mid 1970s in Current Anthropology, a long research article that made a similar claim, was based on a similar idea. That is that in fact North America had been settled by folks, by Western European Upper Paleolithic people. So that's been around for a long time. But if you're gonna, we have so much evidence that indicates that people came from Asia, from Northeast Asia into the New World. Right. We have so much archaeological evidence, geological evidence, and genetic evidence that if you're going to say, no, 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 that's all wrong, you have to rewrite the history books, the evidence has to be a whole lot stronger than a single point with uncertain provenience.
So why do you think then that Bradley and Stanford are so invested in the Solutrean point and the Solutrean presence in North America?
Well, I mean, you'd have to ask them. I mean, I think Stanford has always been.
I guess that was kind of a not fair question to really be asking. I know you can't identify their motives, but maybe there's like something in their writings that kind of hints towards why.
No, I don't think there's like some psychological need on their part. Dennis Stanford has always been real cutting edge.
No, I mean, like, do they have a piece of evidence that they're just like, no, this is it, done?
No, but you know, I think that that's hard. That's always hard to find in archaeology, right?
Yeah.
But I think that they're both good scientists and good scholars, and they've got an idea that they've glommed onto, and that they think that they've got, that they've got the evidence that's going to cause us all to rewrite those history books, and maybe someday, maybe that will. They will have that evidence, but as of right now, they certainly don't. And they have so much explaining to do, and so much kind of massaging that they have to do, because again, the evidence just isn't there. Certainly, it pales in comparison to the evidence that supports the notion that folks came into the New World via a land bridge connecting, or through Beringia, connecting Northeast Asia and Northwest North America.
Now, before we get into that evidence, because as you say, there's no doubt. I don't think in most people in archaeology's minds that the Bering land bridge is right. How people got here. I don't think there's a very large camp of people that don't agree with that. Yeah. And I want to make sure that people understand that we are moving beyond Stanford and Bradley at this point, because we are filing them in the back, and we're moving on to fringier thoughts.
Sure.
Into the actual fringe. But we're still dealing with the Solutrean, and it's important because, as Ken has pointed out, the Solutreans are a European culture that is thought to have been maritime, or people are hoping was maritime, because of how they would have had to have gotten to North America. And this becomes important because when you start looking into some of the uglier sides of the fringe, particularly the what we call race realists and supremacists, basically, they really glob onto the idea of the Solutrean migration and the Solutrean's first hypothesis, because for them, it validates their ideas that a white European race is a superior race. And so for them, if a white European culture made it to America first, it's like being the first person to comment on a thread, you know, it makes them better than everyone else.
And again, this has nothing to do with Bruce Bradley.
Absolutely nothing to do with this too.
And there are a number of others. There are some archaeologists who are who are skeptical, yet a lot more, not open-minded isn't even the right word, but they will not be totally shocked. I'll be totally shocked if definitive evidence is brought forth that shows that, yep, the Solutreans were here. There are some colleagues of mine who they are skeptical, but they wouldn't be totally shocked.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, before we go any further, we should make that distinction. I am not saying that everyone who believes in the Solutrean hypothesis belongs in the category of race realist or basically a racist. I'm not saying that. Please don't read that into it. What I am saying is that there are groups of race realists and racists who support the Solutrean hypothesis, because if it is true, then it supports their idea of racial superiority, which even if it was true, it doesn't do that. So, you know, we're not trying to push an agenda on someone who it doesn't belong in. I do want to talk about people who are trying to push an agenda that there's no evidential backing for ever.
Right. Yeah. And I think, but I think that, that as we said earlier, that this is part of a, there's an ignoble history here. There's a tradition of people looking at the archaeology of North America and wanting to somehow disassociate the modern native people.
Yes.
Modern meaning 17th century, 18th century, or 21st century. It's disassociating them from the amazing archaeological record that's here on this continent and ascribing it to somebody else, often white folks. This is why we saw in the 18th and 19th centuries people saying, no, the Indians, they could not have built the mounds. They're not smart enough, or they don't work hard enough. It must be somebody else. And though somebody else often was supposed to be, you know, white folks from Europe. And this, in some ways, this meant, well, us white folks taking the continent, we're just taking it back from these Indians who came and wiped out the mound builders. And I think that that thread is running through here, and you're absolutely right.
Yes.
There are a bunch of folks who grab onto this and say, oh yes, in fact, the Indians are just a minor historical accident here in North America. It really was first settled by hardy, manly men who somehow managed to cross the ice floes and plant their flag here in North America, and they were from Europe. They were Aryans or whatever. And
yeah, there are people saying that. I think the highest arrogance of that entire fantasy, because it really is a fantasy, is the assumption that those people were white.
Well, yes.
You know, I mean,
if you look at the genetics, and we're doing these folks doing genetics on skeletons are doing an amazing job.
Yeah.
Is that as of right now, it appears that the kind of the general European genome wasn't established until about 8,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So that the Salutrians, we don't know what the hell they looked like.
Exactly.
That's 10,000 years before the kind of modern mitochondrial haplogroups and modern genomes were established. You know, there's somebody 8,000 years ago in Europe, you could look at them genetically and say, okay, yeah, they're European.
Right.
But before that, it's all bets are off.
Right, exactly. And that's what people don't understand. Yeah. And that's where the genetics arguments really kind of make me squiggy, because it's just, you know, there's oh my God. So there's people out there who put on their profiles on like Facebook and Google and Twitter and that. They apparently have sent their,
oh my God,
their genes in and have gotten their genetic codes back, and they will put on their profiles the fact that they belong to certain European haplogroups, as if that's somehow proving them to be whiter than thou.
Well, listen,
and it's disgusting and it's weird.
It drives me crazy. And we absolutely should bring on a biological anthropologist to talk
about. Yes.
So the companies that you they'll send you a kit for $100,
you spit on a Q-tip,
and they tell you who you are. The ads that are on TV now are absolutely horrible. They're reprehensible. In one of them, there's a guy who says, "Well, you know, I always was told that I was, you know, German. And we used to go to like German parties. We ate German food. Then I sent my spit in, and it turns out I'm really Scottish." No, no, you asshole! If you were raised German, you're German. What the
hell?
Your genes don't. That genetic test doesn't mean anything. But the worst one, Sarah, I've seen this just recently, where a woman says, "Well, I was always told that I was, and I think it's like Italian. But I sent my genes in, and it turns out I'm an American Indian." And while she's talking about this, on the table behind her, she has a completely ersatz looking, like kind of Southwestern Indian pot, but the kind you can buy for like $1 because no self-respecting native ceramicist would make it. And right next to that pot is a little toy totem pole. So she's got a Northwest Coast Indian icon, a Southwest Indian icon, both of them fake, and that somehow, and she's got those now because her genes show that she's a Native American.
Yeah,
it's just total crap.
We have an entire episode that we need to do just discussing how race and culture are not the same thing.
Right, yeah. That's crazy stuff.
Yeah, that's, yeah. So, but anyway, my point, before we digressed into this rather important topic, honestly, is the fact that the Zelutrian hypothesis is unfortunately being used to bolster race realists and racist fringe groups. And this is another issue in academia, and it's not academia's fault. It's just sometimes when these things get published and then the public gets a hold of it, you know, they can run off in tangents with things and you have no control over it.
Yeah. And also it shows that we've got to be a lot more careful and how we phrase things so that it can't be misinterpreted. Listen, when Kennewick Man, right, that was the guy found in, what was it, in Oregon, Washington?
Yes.
Kennewick. 9,600-year-old skeleton, really super important. And Jim Chatters, who's a great guy and a wonderful researcher, who at some point said, you know, at first we thought he was a white settler based on the shape of his head. He had Caucasoid characteristics. People read Caucasoid and heard in their brains Caucasian.
Yep.
Caucasoid just means similar to. Caucasian means somebody actually descended from somebody from the Caucasus Mountains.
Right.
And they ran with that. And the absurdity there was you actually had, what were they called? The Asatru group. These were a group of kind of latter-day Norsemen, like living in Wisconsin.
Well, hang on, Ken, because this is going to be important. Let's go to break, and then we'll come back, and we'll pick up with the Norsemen.
You betcha.
The Archaeology and Ale podcast presents a monthly series of lectures on all aspects of archaeology. These lectures are part of the Archaeology in the City program, hosted by the University of Sheffield in England, and are held at the Red Deer Pub near the end of the month. The podcast can be heard a few days later. Check out the Red Deer if you're in the area, or find this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the show.
And we are back. And Ken, you were talking about Norsemen. Yes.
These Norsemen. So what happened was this was soon after the discovery of Kennewick, and it became it was all over the news. And any one of a number of people were claiming that, hey, listen, Native American groups in the Northwest were claiming he is our ancestor, and we don't want a bunch of white scientists poking at him and cutting up his bones, and we want him back in the ground. But there was a group of, I think the name was the Asatru. These guys claimed that, again, because of some of the early assertions that, well, his head is dolichocephalic, which is unlike the Native Americans, and it's, you know, and based on gross morphology of the cranium, these guys were claiming that, in fact, he was an ancient Norseman, the Kennewick fossil, the Kennewick skeleton, and they actually demanded that they be allowed to do traditional ceremonies over the bones, which was crazy. And then when some of the initial genetic work was done, and they said, well, there seems to be some sort of Pacific connection here, there actually was a group of Pacific Islanders living in Los Angeles who claimed that Kennewick Man is actually a Polynesian. So everybody was trying to claim ownership of this poor skeleton. What's really cool is that fairly recently, and I don't have the last couple of years, they finally were able to extract some genetic material from Kennewick.
Mm-hmm.
And he is, you know, it's a long story, but there basically are, five mitochondrial haplogroups in North America, A, B, C, D, and X.
Yes.
And we'll talk a little bit about X because we have to deal with that. But Kennewick Man is haplogroup D, which is like exclusively in North America.
Right.
He is not from Polynesia, and he's not from Europe. He is a Native American.
Right.
And more and more, biological anthropologists have always known, well, for a long time have known, you look at gross morphology of a cranium, it doesn't tell you anything. Even Franz Boas recognized that among Eastern Europeans who moved to the New World because of changes in diet, that skull shape changed like in a generation.
Yeah.
So that the grandparents' head shape and the head shape of their children or grandchildren looked nothing alike, and yet they were the same. They were in the same family.
Yeah.
And so that is actually more plastic. Genetics is not so plastic. So absolutely. I think that I'm trying to remember now. It was off the coast of the on the coast of the Yucatan near Tulum, which is a beautiful Maya site. They recovered in a cenote, in a deep sink. They recovered within the last couple of years the skeleton of a young woman, and again, it's 9 or 10,000 years old, and she's haplogroup D as well. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty typical Native American haplogroup. The thing is, though, and you'll see this in the fringy types, who especially are associated with some segments of the Mormon Church, who claim that when Native Americans are found with haplogroup X, that's proof that in fact those people are from Europe and somehow supports the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, let's get into haplogroup X, because I know we don't have a ton of time left, but it is important to kind of have a base understanding of it.
Here's the deal. Everybody, and you know, I will send you a link to this so you can post it, Sarah.
Will you really?
There's a really, really, really good article, and you can download it for free for nothing as a PDF, by Jennifer Raff from the University of Kansas and Deborah Bolnick. Now, I know Deborah Bolnick. I don't know that I've ever actually met her, but we've co-authored a paper isn't that funny?
Oh, academia.
But she is a biological anthropologist and has done some of the genetic studies of Native American skeletons in mound sites in Ohio. Mm-hmm. So she's got a long history of doing amazing genetic work. And they published a paper called "Does Mitochondrial Haplogroup X Indicate Ancient Transatlantic Migration to the Americas, a Critical Reevaluation?" And it's in a journal called Paleo America. And the second we get off the phone, I'll send you this, I'll send you the PDF and you can post the link to it. But the deal here is, one of the points that they make is, you know, you can't look at these things simplistically, that haplogroup X has several subgroups.
Yes.
And those several subgroups are distributed differently. The haplogroup that is found in the New World, which is X2A, is not the same haplogroup as haplogroup X that's found, the Mormons say that they're found in like the Middle East. The deal is, it's a lot more complicated than that. They're not the same haplogroups. They're not connected. They're not directly connected anyway. I don't know if the people listening to the podcast are aware of this, again, amazing genetic analysis of the Anzac boy, which is again about a 10,000 year old skeleton from Montana. The cool story there is that, and I can't remember the woman's name is Anzac, Susan Anzac, I think. She actually grew up on the farm where the skeleton was found.
Oh, cool.
And then she was so excited when it was discovered, like 20 years ago or 25 years ago, so excited by it that she went to college to major in biological anthropology, went to grad school, and when the scientists came to the skeleton had been found on her father's farm, I guess, and when the scientists wanted to do the analysis, she said yes, but only if I'm allowed to be part of the team and analyzing it.
Nice.
So that's really pretty cool. And the little guy, the Anzac boy, is haplogroup X2A, mm-hmm. And guess what? There's a little boy found at the site of Malta, which is in Siberia near Lake Baikal. And that little boy in Siberia is the same haplogroup. The same thing happens when we look at Y chromosomes. Y chromosomes for the skeletons, when those are recoverable from skeletons in the New World, they are not Asian or African or Australian or Polynesian. They are a Native American, and they can be traced to Northeast Asia.
Yes.
So the genetic evidence there, and you know, anybody who wants to argue with Jennifer Raff and Deborah Bolnick, good luck, because these folks, these women know what they're talking about and have done. And they understand that people looking at it from a very simple perspective, well, there's X here, there's X there, there's a connection. They do a really good job in this article of indicating how Yeah, you need to go look beyond the gross groupings and look at the subgroupings.
Well, I don't think a lot of people are aware that there are subgroups. I think
maybe that's the problem.
Well, I know it has to be some of the problem because when I was in school, we were just told there are haplogroups, done.
Right.
You know, so there wasn't even a discussion about subgroups. So I know a lot of people that are only casually aware of these things probably don't understand that there are subgroups to the X. And then you get the people that do understand that there are subgroups, but they don't understand that the subgroups are not like directly related. Because to some people, when you say there are subgroups of X, but X is found in Europe, therefore the subgroups of X are like the children of the parent group. So,
right. Yeah. Now what in, I think this is in an article in Nature by Morten Rasmussen and his colleagues, when they looked at the Anzac boys' DNA and the Yucatan girls' DNA, that's what they call her. They're both haplogroup D. And what they conclude based on all of this kind of this meta study is that it's like 86% of Native American ancestry derives from East Asia. And the part that doesn't is that, well, it's also the case that people living in East Asia were mating with people who were further to the west,
yeah,
and moving through those areas. So yeah, they're going to be, you know, that's the notion that human groups have ever been able to build a wall around them and, you know, maintain racial, that's in scare quotes, purity,
right,
is nonsense. Wherever people go, you know, the old idea that wherever people go, they fight wars. Wherever people go, they fight wars, sure, but they also have sex and they have kids. And so there's gene flow always going on. But when you look at Native Americans, it's abundantly clear genetically they're from East Asia.
Yeah.
Now, that's complicated in itself because the people in East Asia are not isolated.
Right.
And they came from someplace. But that fundamentally, they're... I know what Raff and Bolnick indicate is that if the Solutrians came into North America, we would see their genetic signature, and we absolutely don't.
Right.
Now does that mean we never will? No.
It just means we haven't found it yet.
Yeah. And just, you know, coulda doesn't mean did. It's lots of things could have happened, but without evidence to support those things having happened, they remain unproven hypotheses.
Right. And as you said earlier in the show, you know, we need a whole lot more evidence to support a claim like that.
Yeah.
That has been offered.
We have what I believe to be definitive evidence that human beings came into the New World maybe as much as 30,000 years ago, probably 25,000 years ago, based on the Monte Verde site has recently been gone back to by Tom Dillahay. And they've got stuff now that dates to 18,500. Well, you're way down on the coast of South America. It's going to take a while for people to get there from Beringia, which is what probably happened.
Right.
And so the notion that people entered into the New World and again, genetically, archaeologically, looking at glaciology, looking at geology, somewhere between 20 and 30,000 years ago is sounding pretty good. And we have pre-Clovis sites. I think those are indisputable at this point.
We have pre-Clovis really sites, but they are not Solutrean sites. We should distinguish that.
Right. We have a really good model. Does that mean we are absolutely that model is etched in stone, which is a weird phrase for an archaeologist because we like stone. But the bottom line here is, no, it's not. It's a model that seems to work, it's a good model for covering everything that we know. If somebody's got something that's going to make us either revise that model or flip it entirely, that's great. If that happens, that's awesome. It just hasn't happened yet.
Right, 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 right. So, yeah. So I think we've talked enough about the Solutrians to the point where I think, or Solutrean being in North America to the point where I think people understand that there's no consensus that they ever made it here, and that the consensus is that the people that we refer to as Native Americans did make it across the Bering. There was a Bering Strait, and they did make it across.
Well, Well, there is a Bering Strait. There was a Bering Landbridge.
Landbridge, yes.
A platform.
I keep calling it the Strait. I don't know why. It's two different.
The Straits are there. The Straits are
there. The Strait's still there, yeah.
And that's another thing that people should know is that historically we know that Inuit people, Eskimos, even when it was, you know, a strait, they moved back and forth.
Yeah.
90 miles for a maritime people who are accomplished sailors was no big deal.
Right. Right.
And that I guess there are times when it even freezes over. So you literally could walk across. There's no land bridge. There actually was an ice bridge at that point.
I think that's where people get confused with the whole ice shelf thing. I think they're thinking of that ice bridge that can form.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, we didn't even touch on the how many migrations came across, because when I was in school, they were teaching us that there were three separate migration patterns or three separate migration periods. And now I'm guessing I've been told that that's actually up for debate.
Well, you know what? It was up for debate for a long time, but now there are some recent articles that basically say the same thing, that there are the first Americans who are the ancestors of that Anzac boy and the Yucatan girl. And those guys are 10, 11, 12,000 years old.
Right.
And that they represent they are the descendants of the first entry into the New World, the first wave, but that there were two subsequent waves into the Arctic, and the Paleo-Arctic cultures and the Thule and the Dorset, and so that kind of two or maybe three waves seems to be getting some support genetically again. So,
good. Okay.
Yay. Which is cool, and it's cool, but it's great that these things are being questioned. There's no problem with that. And as new forms, I mean, this is the three wave pattern was proposed long before there was any genetic evidence to support one wave or two waves or 20 waves. And the bottom line here is something also to point out, just to open it up a little bit. None of this is meant to absolutely categorically deny the possibility that a boatload of people from some other part of the world by sheer accident managed to make it to the New World 10, 15,000 years ago. That could have happened. The issue is here that the archaeological evidence and the genetic evidence shows that if it did happen, they didn't have any impact.
Yeah.
Their genetic signature, a shadow of their genome does not exist.
True. Yeah.
Among Native American Indians, that if there were any archaeological sites indicating that those people were here bearing a different culture with different raw materials and different ways of doing things, no archaeologist has found that.
Right. So, and I know that people like to fall back on the whole Carl Sagan absence of evidence is an evidence of absence, but we're taking that quote out of context as well.
Right.
Because that was Sagan speaking out of frustration towards people who cannot accept an absence of evidence.
And, you know, there's some interesting, I've tracked down some philosophers who have attacked that and basically say, you know, sometimes the absence of evidence is evidence of absence. If somebody, the guy's talking about a college campus, and says, if somebody tells you that there's an elephant on the quad,
right,
and you go out and look for it and you don't find any elephant poop, you probably are in pretty good, you probably are pretty wise to say, no, that the evidence of that absence is that the absence of evidence there is evidence of absence.
Well, and that honestly, that was Sagan's point in the book. It's right. His point was, when there is no evidence, it usually means there's a reason for that.
Right.
And that is because whatever you're looking for isn't there. But as has been pointed out, negative data is still data.
Absolutely.
I heard that a lot when I was going through school, and it has just been brought up again. So negative data is still data.
I tell that to my students when they're digging test pits and not finding anything.
I believe that's just what field school directors tell you to make you not feel bad about the fact that you're digging a sterile pit.
Yes. You tell your diggers, wow, you didn't find anything. That's really important. Yeah. That's great. That's negative evidence is important. And then the field director walks away and laughs under his or her breath. But there is some truth to that.
And then they give you a rock hammer and tell you to go break up the asphalt behind the garage because that's where your next unit's going. So, yes.
That sounds like fun.
Ken, do you feel like there's anything else that needs to be said before we wrap up?
No, here's what I want to tell you, though. I've already emailed you the PDF.
I got the notification. It there is in my inbox.
Yeah. It's a really, both Jennifer Raff and Deborah Bolnick, not only are they terrific scientists, they really write very, very well. And they're not, you know, hard-ass about it. They say, look, this is what the evidence right now indicates. This is the way that the most parsimonious way of interpreting the data. And there we stand. And they come out, they are not, they don't believe that Solutrean hypothesis has any genetic support.
Yeah. And that's kind of the best we can go with for right now.
Right.
So thank you for sending that to me, and thank you for another enjoyable podcast, Ken.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Sarah. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Raise your trials as one will call. No, we don't do a dinosaur.
Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. Our music was provided by ArchaeoSoup Productions. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Stitcher, and share us wherever you use social media. You can contact us with your questions, comments, or angry email at archaefantasies@gmail.com. You can follow the podcast at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaefantasies. You can follow the blog at www.archaefantasies.com and get updates on Tumblr and Twitter at Archie Fantasies. You can also look for us on Facebook. If you're looking for the show notes for this episode, go to the podcast website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaefantasies. Thanks again for listening.
No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. We don't do dinosaurs.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.